The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for October 21st, 2017. Brian and I are actually in Israel this week, riding along with the FIDF, the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces. If you're interested in following our trip, we are reporting daily via Facebook, the Outspoken Cyclist page, Twitter, at Outspoken Cyclist without an E, and Instagram. You can see Brian's Instagram photos and comments at Artispin, A-R-T-I-S-P-I-N, and I am at Diane Jenks. Of course, this show has been recorded earlier in the week, and I hope you enjoy it. The Philly Bike Expo is coming up November 4th and 5th, so it's time to check in with Bina Belinky-Trahan to see what's new for 2017. The Philly Bike Expo has become the place to go on the East Coast to see the widest variety of builders, accessories, apparel, components, as well as attend a huge number of workshops and seminars on topics ranging from advocacy and sustainability to wheel building and bike fitting. Bina will fill us in on the details in a moment. Then after a short break, we're going to talk with Toby Stanton from Hot Tubes and the Hot Tubes Racing Team. The first part of my conversation with Toby covers painting and frame repair and delves into some of the nuances of paint that may never have occurred to you. They didn't to me. And then the second half of the conversation with Toby covers bike racing. But wait, this is not your usual explanation of our sport. Toby's perspective, which has led to one of the longest-lasting and most successful junior development teams in U.S. history, goes to some fundamental ideas and ideals that may now lead to some of the most successful U.S. bike racing ever. So it's out to Philadelphia. Let's talk with Bina Belinky-Trahan about the upcoming Philly Bike Expo. Hi, Bina. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. It's Philly Expo time again.
Thanks, Diane, for having me.
It is my pleasure. As always, unfortunately, Brian and I will not be there because we're going to be in Israel riding, and I'm really, really excited for you. The show looks fabulous this year.
Thank you. Well, we'll certainly miss you, but hopefully we'll see you next year.
I hope so. So let's talk about the Philly Bike Expo, November 4th and 5th. It seems that your seminar program has just exploded.
Yeah, it has. We actually had to add a third meeting room, so we'll be having three seminars running simultaneously throughout both days.
And why don't you give us a rundown on a couple of the newer ones, ones that haven't been covered in the past?
Sure. So this year, a new one, we have Bicycles and Social Justice. It's presented by Brandel Randolph. He has a bicycle company called 1854 Cycling Company. They actually had an article written about them recently in Bloomberg. But he teaches recently released prisoners how to build bikes in his shop. And so he's going to be talking about bicycles and social justice and how the bicycle industry can help.
Wow, that's what a fascinating topic.
I know. I'm hoping that our recording will work so I can hear this one after the fact, because I never get to hear any of the seminars.
That's the bane of being the director. You don't get to do all those things.
Exactly.
Right. What else is coming up?
Well, another one I'm really excited about is Kimberly Coates is coming and doing a presentation on the history of Team Rwanda. And I got really interested in that when we went and stayed at the Rwanda Cycling Center a couple years ago. And so she'll just be talking about their work there and basically how they've inspired an entire continent of cycling.
Yeah, Team Rwanda, or it's Team Africa Rising, I think. And just, she's amazing. She and Jacques both. I'm really glad that she's able to come to the Philly Bike Expo. So you have some new exhibitors this year, I take it also?
We do. I hate to list names because I don't want to sound like I'm playing favorites, but we have a lot of new, really cool companies coming this year. Chinelli signed up for the first time. Also, Chris Chance from Fat Chance Bicycles is coming.
I can't believe I'm going to miss this.
I know. Let's see. FSA, Moots, Pedalino Bicycles. She's a female frame builder. They're all new this year. Ergon and Rotor. There's a lot of new ones this year.
You know, it's interesting. It seems like the Philly Bike Expo is becoming a real consumer trade show, something that will cover the gamut of cycling from like A to Z and attract so many of the industry important people, from manufacturing all the way through to advocacy. It's really, really, you've done such a great job, Bina.
Thank you. And yes, speaking of industry, new this year, we're going to do industry only hours each morning to give the industry the opportunity to, you know, connect with the companies before it opens to the public.
How many people are you expecting this year? Do you have any concept, because it's expanded so much?
We kind of, you know, project based on previous years, but somewhere around 4,000 is what we're expecting.
Yeah, you might be surprised. Maybe it's going to be more. But I know that, you know, the space has gotten so big. I can remember the first ones at the Armory, and now you've got the convention center. So let's tell people where the expo is being held, when, and how they can find out more and get tickets.
Sure. It's held at the Pennsylvania Convention Center, which is right downtown. It's in Hall E, the Broad Street entrance. It's November 4th and 5th, which is Saturday and Sunday. It's 10 to 5 on Saturday and 10 to 4 on Sunday. And people can go on our website at phillybikeexpo.com to get the full schedule and also to buy tickets.
Well, I wish you so much luck. Again, we are so sorry we won't be there. We will keep track of what's going on. I know everybody posts pictures. Everybody posts information. You know, you can find out stuff anywhere. So even while we're out of the country, we'll be able to tell. Although I think we'll be back by then. It's just, we'll be just back by then. So good luck with the show.
Thank you. I said you'll be a little jet lagged.
Just a little, but that's okay. I'll still check in to see what's going on. Thanks so much for talking with me. I know you have lots and lots of things to do, and thanks for filling us in on the Philly Bike Expo.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye. We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. Here is part one of my conversation with Toby Stanton from Hot Tubes. Hi, Toby. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me. It was nice meeting you and chatting at the New England Builders Ball this year.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yeah. Well, I want to introduce you to my listeners. Tell us a bit about Toby and Hot Tubes.
Well, Hot Tubes is a painting and frame building and carbon repair shop in central Massachusetts, in a little tiny orchard town called Shirley. I started the shop in 1991. There's two of us here, Jordan, Lowe, and me, and that's what we do every day, is paint high-end bikes and do carbon repair on, generally speaking, high-end road, triathlon, mountain bikes.
You know, I have sort of an interest in paint and also carbon repair, but my interest in paint is it's not easy. You know, people think you just take a rattle can and, you know, kind of spray it down, but the stuff you do is really kind of technical. If you go to your website, the first picture that comes up is just mind-boggling how you do that stuff. So if you had to say three things about paint and what's important, what would they be?
It is way harder and more time-consuming than anyone thinks. It's the most expensive and time-consuming aspect of frame building.
Wow.
New builders are often surprised at how expensive paint is, but the material, we use the best material that's available. So it's the best automotive urethane that you can buy, from the epoxy primer to the color coats to the clear coats. The clear is $350 a gallon.
Wow.
The color is usually about $150 a pint. So these materials are the best you can get. And although it doesn't take a lot of the material, it's expensive to get. And the cumulative cost, materials cost of painting a bike is high. What else? It takes longer, generally speaking, to paint a bike than it does to build a bike.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I saw that part of the process is that you do something in between every coat. How many coats of paint go on? Let's talk about a metal bike, first of all. Well, how many paints of coat go on a steel bike, for example?
So first it gets stripped, and that is typically for a steel frame, it gets blasted with a very soft DuPont material called Star Blast, which basically leaves the metal very clean and with a surface texture about equivalent to 600 grit sandpaper.
Hmm.
So to paint and have it adhere really well, you need a chemical bond and a mechanical bond. The chemical bond requires cleanliness, so it needs to be spotlessly clean. No dust, no grease, no paint, no anything left like that. So the blasting gives it a mechanical bond. So if you looked at it microscopically, there would be all of these ridges and valleys. And that allows the epoxy primer that we use, which is a catalyzed primer, to really bite. So epoxy is the strongest primer you can get. And the catalyzed makes it harder. It's the best primer that you can buy. So we apply, depends on the bike, we apply three coats in general of epoxy, which gets baked. And all the baking process does is it speeds things up. So I can cure epoxy primer in half an hour in an oven, where typically you would let it air dry and cure for 24 hours. So that just allows us to keep things moving. We'll apply three coats of that, but then we'll wet sand it with 600 grit, and we will probably take a full coat off to get it perfectly flat. The goal is to start with a perfectly flat surface. Now, if it's an old steel bike and it had some rust damage, after we stripped it, we would fill with a plasticized body filler, essentially aircraft-grade Bondo. We would fill any surface imperfections, any pinholes, any little rust damage like that with that. Then we get epoxy primer, then it gets baked, then wet sanded, then it gets cleaned. Once it's dry, then it's ready for color coats. And color isn't a strong element. There isn't body to it. So having a lot of color doesn't help you. It doesn't make it more durable. So you want enough color to achieve the look that you want. So if you're doing fades or you're doing panels and things like that, it's kind of hard to tell how many coats. Every color covers differently. Metallics tend to cover a little better because they have an aluminum flake in it, which is opaque, so you can't see through it, so it doesn't tend to take as much of that. But every color is different, and it's really up to the painter's eye in the booth to decide when it's flat, level, and completely covered. Then that cures, and typically, so that's not a catalyzed. In general, there are catalyzed colors, but for us, we use a base coat, clear coat system. So the color isn't catalyzed. It's a solvent carrier. So as soon as the solvent evaporates, the color is dry.
How long does that take?
Depends.
Okay.
Depends on how heavy you lay it down.
Yeah, okay.
So if you do light coats with a flash time in between, which allows the solvents to evaporate, it's dry really quickly, 5-10 minutes. But if you laid it down really heavy, it could be half an hour, an hour. I mean, it depends. You don't tend to want to put color on heavy ever, because the surface dries, but the solvents remain trapped underneath, depending on the weather. So paint is very susceptible to humidity and temperature. It changes how fast it dries and how fast it skins over, things like that. So you constantly have to adjust your technique to take into consideration the environmental concerns. Having a climate-controlled shop helps. But in the summer, when there's high humidity, things are different than they are in the winter when it's low humidity. Once you've got the color down and that's dry, then you're good. If you're doing an old steel bike, an old Colnago or a DeRosa or Fat Chance, something like that, and you want to use original decals, this is the time you'd apply them. And we, in general, use decals from the manufacturer that actually made them. There's one guy, and he made almost all the decals for everybody.
Really?
Only everybody in the U.S.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. He's a very quiet guy down in North Carolina, and he has everything. He has Bianchi's, Bottega, Le Mans, Specialized, just everybody. He has everything. And he makes the highest quality screen-printed old school decals that you can get.
How about tubing decals like Reynolds and
yep.
Columbus?
Yes.
Wow. No
kidding.
He has
those as well. So you can get the vintage ones. If you, like, we were an authorized Cerata repainter when they existed.
Right.
We can still get the original Cerata Columbus tubing decals, the CS2, CS1 tubing decals, things like that.
Let me ask you a question. Are there any colors that are really almost impossible to paint?
Chrome. So people see chrome on bikes sometimes, and often they're done in Asia. There are some versions of it, but I have yet to find a chrome paint that looks like chrome.
Interesting. Somebody told us a long time ago that yellow is hard to paint.
Nah, yellow shows everything.
Okay.
It shows dirt. So if you touch it, it'll show a fingerprint. It's hard that way. So to shoot yellow properly, you have to shoot it white first, because it's what allows yellow to be vivid. The same with fluorescent colors. So fluorescents are one of those, I wish people wouldn't do them. They look
right.
Really good out of the box.
Yeah.
But they fade. Because they are so vivid, so intense, those properties are also really susceptible to UV light. So they fade. If you've looked at traffic cones or anything, any fluorescent something that's been out in the sun a long time, they fade. And they're really, even though the clear coats that we have UV inhibitors, you can't stop it all. You
right.
can't prevent fluorescent colors from fading. But if you really want it and you're okay with the idea that it isn't going to be as fluorescent in 2 years, great, go ahead.
I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Toby Stanton from Hot Tubes. And I wanted to ask you, I know that, you know, everything's carbon these days, carbon all the way down, although I'm sure you're still painting a lot of metal. You're doing carbon repair. So that business is booming, I assume, since everybody seems to crash his or her carbon bike?
It's pretty busy, yeah. So it's getting busier. The problem right now is letting people know that we do it. It's hard to get that information out. Unless you're in all of the bike shops or you have some way to get to them, people know of Calfee and some of the ones out in California, but very few know that it's an option on the East Coast.
Well,
to get it done.
You're going to have a bunch more people know now.
I hope so. Thank
well,
you.
I think we have a lot of East Coast listeners. So are there carbon frames that just aren't worth the price of repair?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Cheap, Chinese bikes for two reasons. One, they're inexpensive to replace because they were inexpensive to buy initially. Secondly, they, in general, they are made with a lower grade carbon and resin, which so you need to understand how we do a carbon repair is slightly different than a lot of carbon repair guys out there. Most carbon repair guys out there use what's called a wet layup technique, which is you buy carbon fabric, and it comes like fiberglass fabric, and you mix a two-part epoxy resin. Typically, you would get it at a boatyard. That the West system is what most guys commonly use, which is a very good resin, but not spectacular, not for this application. It's really good for fixing boats. It's really good for fixing canoes, but it isn't the best, in my view, for fixing bikes, which are made of, generally speaking, higher grade resin, carbon and resin. So the kind of technique that we do for repairing carbon is we use the kind of material that the bike was made with initially, which is a pre-impregnated, it's called prepreg, which just means it's pre-impregnated with a resin from the manufacturer, which is a heat-activated resin. So when most carbon bikes are made, they're made in a mold, and they take this UD prepreg, which is unidirectional prepreg, and unidirectional prepreg is very, very thin, but all the fibers run one direction. So you do what's called a laminate schedule, which is the order of which you lay down the sheets of prepreg and how you vary them off of 0 degrees or 90 degrees, and that determines how the frame is going to react. So carbon is very stiff in length, but not from the sideways to the fiber. So by varying the angles, you can end up with an isotropic joint, one that is universally strong in all directions. But you can control how the repair is going to react based on how you orient the UD fibers.
Got it.
And you can't buy UD. Well, you actually can now, but in the past you hadn't been able to buy unidirectional carbon that was not in a prepreg state. Now, why don't most people use prepreg? Because it's harder to work with, and it requires a very sophisticated oven to cook it. It has to be cooked for a very specific time at a very specific temperature, and you really need to control it. You can't stick it in a pizza oven because you will damage the underlying frame. So it has to be done very, very carefully, and that requires a really expensive oven. You also need to create a certain amount of pressure on it to evacuate any air and any excess resin. So it's a fairly involved process that involves a decent amount of capital investment up front. Most wet layup stuff, anybody could do. Like, you can buy the stuff locally almost anywhere in the country and do it yourself. The difference between going to someone like Calfee is the knowledge, knowing how it needs to be aligned, how it needs to be oriented and laid up to maintain the structural integrity.
You know what? We're going to take a real quick break, and we're going to come back to talk about Hot Tube's junior development team. That's so interesting, Toby. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We're back. We're talking with Toby Stanton from Hot Tubes, and that was so interesting, all that carbon and paint, and I learned a whole lot. I love that. So I don't want to let you go until we talk about something that Hot Tubes does that a lot of people don't do, and that is you support cycling with a team and you support juniors. Tell us about your development team, how that works, and how long you've been doing it.
I started my team in 1992. That was when we went to the first national championships. I had Jonathan Page then of Cyclocross Note. And we went to our first nationals in Bloomington, Indiana. And Jonathan ended up winning, which put us in sort of an odd spot because it meant we had to come back the next year since we were defending national champs. So I didn't go. I didn't start it in 92 with the intent to be where we are. It just sort of happened.
Oh, well, that's too bad.
Yeah, it's so that was it. It started because I had a van and I could drive some local kids to races. I had stopped racing because I had young kids and I just, there wasn't time to be with my kids and to train. So I gave up on my own racing and got asked to take some young guys, young local guys to some races, and I could bring my kids to those.
Right.
So that's what I ended up doing. And it just sort of grew and grew, and we had more success in the following years. And so we started to do bigger races, and we got a little more support locally and from some industry sponsors. And that allowed us to go to even bigger races, and we continued to sort of win on a national championship level. And then we went to Europe in the late 90s, and we won. The first big international race we won was in 1997 in Canada, Tour of Abitibi. And back then, Americans have won it a lot in recent years, but back then it was a different race. The big European teams came, and it was really hard. Only one American, two Americans had ever won it leading up to my rider back then winning, Will Frischkorn, who went on to ride professionally on Garmin and got second on a stage in the Tour de France.
Wow. Is your team still in existence?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
We're still going now. I've got four guys that are alumni of the team in the Pro Tour right now. Ian Boswell on Sky.
Right.
Nate Brown and Lawson Craddock on Cannondale Drapac. Ben King on Dimension Data.
Wow.
Caleb Fairley, who was Giant Alpecin and HTC Columbia and Garmin, he was also on my team. So, yeah, those are alumni that are doing it. Half of Axel Merckx's guys on the Action team were my old riders, or at least a lot of his guys are my old riders.
How do you find these young people who are, first of all, not only are they committed, but their families have to commit to helping them move along in the sport? It's a tough sport.
It is, and it's an expensive sport. Fortunately, we have really good financial supporters. So there's this group of basically wealthy guys that look at what we do, and we emphasize academics. So of my sort of recent alumni, I have two guys from Princeton, two guys from Dartmouth, one at Colorado School of Mines, one at Stanford. So we have a high academic standard and expectation. And they believe that through competitive cycling and the stresses that you go through to race at a high level, that the skills and the things that you learn and the character elements that are refined by that level of competition end up making much better people, much better citizens, much better business leaders, much better military guys. They like the guys that go on to race pro, but the motivation of the team has never been to generate professional racers. It's just been a byproduct of the system. So these guys, these core group of wealthy guys, don't have a business interest in this. They don't have a business name on the jersey. They just like supporting something that they love. Competitive bike racing, but more than that, they just love these guys. You know, they love the end product. And some of them go on to become great, great bike racers, professional bike racers. But not all of them. Most don't. But almost all of them go on to experience success in some other aspect of their life. And these supporters think that that's important, that young guys need guidance and support to stay on a good path early and to learn the benefits of teamwork, of hard work, of sporting ethics, of just doing things as they should be done. We would rather lose than cheat to win. We would rather lose than go to a gray ethical edge to win. There's no satisfaction in that for us. We've won a lot. We don't need to win anymore. I want to win on the day of the race.
Right.
But I won't do anything to do that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I got what you're saying. I wish people would take that into their lives. You know, if...
Oh, I think... So one of my old riders back in the 90s was a super big anti-doping guy. And he was really pretty much a loudmouth about it. Like, he just went on and on. And I had told him, I said, look, the way that we're going to change this is through evolution, not revolution. We need to just replace all these guys that think that they had to dope with guys that don't. And eventually all the older, you know, doper guys are going to go away, and we're going to replace them with a generation of guys that don't believe that's necessary. And that's essentially what's happened. You know, that these young guys, especially the young American pros now, these are clean, ethical guys, and they're successful on the world stage now. I mean, you just look at all of the young pros that we have on all of the pro tour teams, on all of the really good domestic teams, on Axel Merckx's team. I mean, all of the under-23s, Brandon McNulty's and Adrian Costas and Nielsen Paulus. I mean, these guys are young, ethical, clean, and world-class. And so it just took time. And that belief that I don't have to dope to be successful. And so we just keep preaching that story and letting these guys grow older and find their way in cycling or in business, but just bring that attitude that you don't have to cheat to be successful in anything that you're doing. And I think that mentality is seeping in right now in at least U.S. cycling. I mean, you can see it. Just look at look at the guys that are the guys that people want to watch now. They like them. They're ethical guys. They're guys that you want to be around. And that's what's exciting for people. It isn't the winning as much as it is the character, I think, that people appreciate in these guys.
Well, I certainly hope it begins to expand into the greater peloton. Obviously, cycling has been damaged so badly in the past 10, 15 years. I don't know. I'm hoping these kids absolutely become the new face of cycling beyond the U23 teams.
Oh, yeah. No, they are. The difference is that juniors are 17 and 18, and then the under-23s are 4 years in that category. So it's just going to take time for these guys to go through the junior ranks and then through the under-23 ranks on into the professionals. I mean, you're talking about a 6, 7, 8 year development, and even 8 years in, they're still considered young professionals on the world tour stage. The Nate Browns and Lawsons and Ians, these are still young guys. And when they were racing, you know, when they were juniors, the doping culture in bike racing was full on. So it just is going to take a certain amount of time. But I don't think that the damage that was done was as permanent or severe. It was really bad at the time, and it was prevalent. It was everywhere. But I don't think, if you look at it from the fans' point of view, and the sponsors look at it from the fans' point of view, because they're the only ones they're concerned with. They sponsor it because this is media impressions, and I want to get my product in front of as many fans as possible. The fans don't care. But the fans, when these old guys go away, the new generation of juniors now that are aspiring to be pro racers, when you ask them about old riders from 10 or 15 years ago, doped or not, with the exception of Lance, they hardly know any of their names, and they know almost nothing about them. So it's old guys that still remember and are still a little bitter about having felt cheated, you know, but they still loved watching those races, and those fans never went anywhere. They bitched and moaned, but they came back, and they're there now, and they're watching all of these new young guys with the same passion and excitement that they watched the old tours with Lance and George and Discovery and Postal Service and all those. So I don't think cycling was as injured as people felt like it would be.
Interesting. I think you're one of the few people who looks at it like that.
There isn't a drop-off in young participation. There are as many juniors now as I've really ever seen, and the quality of them is better than it has ever been. There are more high-level American juniors now than I have ever seen.
I think that's awesome.
It is. It's great. I'm excited every single time. It's funny. I've been doing this since 92, and every time this year, I'm super excited about planning for next year's team, what races we're doing, who I have, how great the young guys that I have are, how much promise they have, what good teams I've got, what the vibe is. I'm excited now, as much now, as I was 25 years ago.
Do you have any women?
I do. So I don't generally have very many for two reasons. One, there just aren't that many out there at the moment. Now, when you say women, I'm talking about junior women now.
Right.
Because I don't want to do seniors.
No, it's junior development. That's what we're talking about.
Right. So the latest one that I had is Emma White, and she is about as perfect a person, an athlete, a representative for us and everything that I value in cycling as I have ever met. She is an extraordinary person. She is an extraordinary athlete. She got a silver medal in the time trial at the World Championships in Richmond. She got a silver medal in the road race at the World Championships in Richmond. But those are great accomplishments, but they pale to who she is. She is so much more than just that. And that's what I'm most proud of. When you meet her, people are in awe when they meet her. And it isn't because of her athletics, even though that is extraordinary. She is just as the most complete young lady I've ever met.
Wow. That's quite an endorsement there.
So prior to her, I had a young lady, Arielle Filiberti, and she went on and won the Junior National Road Championship and was second in the time trial and ended up, she just graduated from medical school. So she's a doctor now. So some go on to cycling. Larson Staley, who was one of my rock stars back in the early 2000s, she was extraordinary. She was sixth at the World Championship. She won a World Championship on the track. And now she is teaching English and getting her PhD in Switzerland.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So this is the level of person that we end up with. And however we get there, whether they were going to be that anyway or we helped them along the way, this is the, you know, when you look at it down the road, that this is who they are now. And that's exciting and cool for me. So I do periodically take on a young lady as an athlete on the team. It is difficult for me to have young women on the team on a predominantly young man's team, because we travel a lot together, and which adds expense and logistical things, because we can't even have the remotest hint of impropriety. So that means separate rooms, always chaperone, just things that make it more difficult than just having 6, 17, 18-year-old guys who I can double up in hotel rooms and none of it's an issue. With young ladies, we have to be super, super strict. And that takes a lot of effort. It's been incredibly well worth it for the young women that we've had on this team. I am incredibly proud of these young ladies.
I have one last question, and that is, what would you say to a young boy or young girl who wants to be a cyclist, who wants to race his or her bike, who wants to be at the level of your junior riders?
Get good coaching. And there's a lot of good coaching out there. And it doesn't have to be expensive. There are a lot of guys out there now that want to help these young guys. Want to give back. They want to start giving back. And they have a lot of knowledge. So the key things are, do good races. Don't just go and do senior races. Senior races are hard and fast, but they don't teach you how to race. Doing the big junior races, the national level junior races that are tactical, teach you how to think. Because ultimately, if they're good, they're going to race in Europe. And the racing in Europe is a very different style than Pro 1-2 racing in the U.S. So if they're proficient and good at that U.S. Pro 1-2 racing, I've seen so many go to Europe and get their butts handed to them because they don't understand how to do it. So get good coaching, do the good races in the U.S., race the junior races here, and get yourself noticed. Get in contact with the regional USA Cycling coaching guys. So if they're good enough to win locally and regionally, they're going to get an invitation to go to an ID camp, one of the USA Cycling talent ID camps. Go and be good. You know, really prepare for it and show up and be good. And understand that your riding is a small part of making it. The world is full of fast bike racers. Don't be the jerk. Be the guy that is on time, that has his bag together, that doesn't forget his shoes or his helmet. Be organized, be self-dependent and responsible. If they say the ride leaves from the portico at 9 o'clock, 9 o'clock is not when you show. 10 of 9, you are down there with your bottles filled, ready to go, tires pumped up. The guy that doesn't get invited is the guy that's unprepared. The guy that, oh, did somebody bring a pump? Does somebody have a spare? You don't want to be that guy, because you're not going to get many opportunities to show your wares in front of guys like me or the national team or any of the other bigger teams in the U.S., You want to be noticed for what you do well, not for what you don't do well. So be organized, be on time, and learn to do it yourself. It is not your parents' responsibility to wipe your butts. Take care of yourself. You clean your own bike. You be responsible for your equipment. Be responsible for your bottles. Learn to do all of that for yourself.
Wow, because Toby.
In Europe, no one's going to hold your hand.
Yeah, no kidding.
And if you don't know how to do it, you're going to be home pretty quick and disappointed and not understand why you didn't make it, and that's why. Not because you weren't good enough, but because you didn't do those other things well enough, because you didn't prioritize them. They're so worried about watts and watts per kilo and max power and all of these things. Everybody is within 1 or 2% of each other at the highest level. That's not what separates the guys that win and make it from those that don't. It's all of the other stuff.
Wow.
Respectful, polite, always talk to, I tell this to my guys, when you meet somebody that you don't know at a race or whatever, it may be the grandparents of somebody, some kid that you just whooped in a race. You treat them as if they are your grandparents' best friends. Yes, ma'am, no, sir. You be polite, respectful, and you give them their full attention, because it may be a guy like me just coming up to say, hello, you did a good job. And if you don't know what I look like and you're trying to get on my team, that impression is going to stay with me.
That is such good advice. And there you are giving it freely.
Well, it's what I tell them. Good or not, it's what I tell them. And it's worked for me so far. I have guys that I'm proud of, that my supporters are proud of, that are impressive adults, and so I like what we're doing.
I like what you're doing too, and I really appreciate you sharing it, because I think that nobody has really spoken to the cyclists in that manner. Nobody has, junior or otherwise, nobody has explained in the kind of detail and the kinds of things that you look for, which lead to success, the way you just did.
Well, it's not the only way. There are plenty of guys that don't do all of those things extremely well, but they made it mostly because they were just so extraordinarily physically gifted. But if you lose those gifts for whatever reason, you don't have anything to fall back on.
Right.
And being the guy that everyone wants to have around because I can count on him, you know, a perfect example of that guy with me that comes to mind is, so Nate Brown, who's on Cannondale Drapac, is one of my old riders. He has a younger brother who has been in my system basically since he was 10, Johnny Brown. He's on Axel Merckx's team now. He is one of the most complete athletes I've ever had. So he was not the strongest guy I ever had. He, you know, there was always guys on the team that could time trial faster or tested better, but he is the only two-time national road champion for 17-18s that has ever been. And there's a reason for it. He is so incredibly well prepared in everything that he does. His race sense, his taking care of his details, his understanding how to work within a team, what he's capable of, and who is the best guy on the team, and what can I do to precipitate somebody on this team winning. The one hallmark I think that my guys have always had is none of them care who wins. They only care that we win. So if it's Johnny Brown working for Jack Maddox or Ethan Reynolds or any of these guys, they can't wait to give up their own personal chance for one of the other guys' chances of success. So we beat so Brandon McNulty is one of the strongest riders the U.S. has ever produced. He was junior world champion last year in the time trial, and he's just an extraordinarily gifted athlete. And his last year as a junior in the national road race, we beat him. We didn't beat him because I had better guys. We beat him because we had such a complete team. And every single rider did their utmost to put our one real chance to beat him in the position he needed to be. And everybody did their job perfectly. And my one rider at that time, Gage Heck, he won because that's what they thought they were supposed to do. And they gave up everyone. That was the most complete race we've ever done, where everybody did exactly what I hoped they could do, what I believed they could do. They each rode to their maximum ability on that one day. And it took that to beat him. And we just barely beat him, but we beat him. And what they took away from that, besides all, you know, they got a national championship, was this understanding. After the race, I watched them all embrace and absorb what they had accomplished. And I don't think any of them really believed that could happen. But when they did it and then they saw that it actually happened, how they view themselves and success and what they're capable of, that changed. And it changed permanently in them. And that's what I look for, that those magic moments when you can see a change happen, where they believe in themselves and they believed in each other and they trusted and it worked. It's not always going to work, even when you do everything to your maximum ability. But that day it did, and it was profound for all of them. Anyway,
so I talked to Johnny Brown this year.
Ah,
he was on my show June 10th. Yeah, as soon as you said his name, I'm like, wait a minute. He was in Austin, and that, yeah.
Yeah.
He's yep. actually very, very grown up for a 20-year-old.
Yes, he is.
And yet he's adorable.
He really is.
He's adorable.
One of the best riders I've ever had. One of the most complete people. I mean, I would hand off this team to Johnny when he's ready. I would trust him with every aspect. He understands how we do it, and his expectation of excellence is just so high.
I remember him saying to me that when he retires, he's already thinking about it, he wants his own junior development team. That was the whole premise of our interview.
Yeah, that's funny. His brother, Nate, who's on Cannondale, he wants my job. In fact, he said it during the Tour de France this year. They had interviewed them on the, and everybody, if you weren't, you know, a pro racer, what would you be doing? And, you know, they were all, oh, I would have, you know, pursued Formula One racing or something like that. Nate was, I'd be running the Hot Tube team. You know, he was just straight up, that's what he wants to do.
Oh, that's
so
hilarious.
When he was 17, we were talking about how to do that financially, about, all right, Nate, when you become a pro, you're going to make X amount of dollars a year, but you only need this amount to live. I need you to be financially so smart that when you are done pro racing, you don't need to become the Southeastern regional rep for Oakley.
Right.
So you can do anything that you want because you were smart with your money, you understand how compounding interest works, and you don't have to make X amount of dollars from this point on because your money is doing it. Now you can use your skill, your experience, and your passion and do something for others. And
wow.
That's what he wants to do, and that's what he's doing.
Well, I'll tell you
and
what.
And Johnny is in that same path.
Yes, he is. Johnny's going right down that same path. Well, I got to tell you, this has been an amazing conversation. Last thing we do need to tell our listeners is how to find out about Hot Tubes and Hot Tubes Junior Development. Where can they go?
Hot Tubes is easy. Go to hottubes.com, and that's the shop website. Anything related to getting bikes fixed or painted, you can get there. HotTubesCycling.com is the team website, and you can see what the team is doing, who we have, where we are, and my contact intel if you have or see a young rider. You asked me how I see young riders. A lot of times I see them at races, but more often than not, somebody tells me. I live in Louisiana. There's this super hot 15-year-old, he's killing everybody in the local, this and that. That's how I find out about them. Somebody I know, I trust, or somebody makes me aware of them, and then I can ask around, hey, what do you know of this guy? That's how I find them. So hottubes.com, if you want shop-related stuff, hottubecycling.com. If you want to tell me about some hotshot, great guy, or you just want to connect with me about something related to the team.
Well, Toby, thank you so much for sharing all this information, for talking with me on the show today. I hope we get to talk again sometime soon.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
If you are interested in learning more about Hot Tubes, you want to get your bike painted or your carbon fiber frame repaired, you can log on to hottubes.com. So that's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed both of my guests. Next week, the show will offer up an encore presentation. We won't be back from our trip to Israel until Friday the 27th, and that's just not enough time to prepare a whole show for you. But our first show for November is a doozy. We'll have Jill Yesko. She's the producer and director of the film Tainted Blood, the story of the 1984 Olympic cycling team and the blood doping scandal that came out of that. And then we're going to have a great conversation with blind paratriathlete Amy Dixon. We should all have her stamina, abilities, and outlook. So remember that you can follow along on our trip via the usual social media. If it's a nice week where you are, we hope you have a chance to go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.